From KXJZ in Sacramento, I'm Jeffrey Callison. Are California community colleges falling short in helping students transfer to university? Two recent studies each concluded there's a problem. The arguments, pro and con, today on Insight. Both studies found colleges facing several big challenges, including a relatively small number of students transferring to CSU and UC. But the community colleges say that finding is overstated and claim a higher success rate. Also today, as the world gets warmer, species will probably start moving to cooler places. Ecologists want to know, should we help them along the way? First, the news. From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, the Earth is warming up and is expected to get hotter still. Many plants and animals will seek cooler homes. A big question among ecologists, should humans give the migrating species a helping hand? First, two recent studies found important problems at California's community colleges. Each concluded that not enough junior college students are completing their degrees or transferring to university. The first study came out late last year. It was published by the Public Policy Institute of California. The second came out last week. It was published by researchers at Sacramento State. We have a wide variety of guests lined up for today, but we'll start with a co-author of each of the studies. First, Rhea Sengupta of the PPIC. She joins us from San Francisco. Rhea, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Your study found that California community colleges are coming up short in two important objectives, graduating students with associate degrees and transferring students to four-year universities. Could you describe the problem for us and give us an idea of its scale?
Sure. In our report, we looked at course taking in California's community colleges, and we found that overall about half of students attended for purposes of taking transfer-level courses, and about 16% took vocational courses, and 14% took a majority of basic skills or ESL courses. And these reasons for attending varied by things such as student age and previous educational level and race and ethnicity. And we also found that there is high turnover in the system, and many students are leaving without achieving their goals. For example, we found that only about a quarter of students who we consider transfer-focused in this study eventually transferred to a four-year institution. And transfer rates vary by things such as age and previous educational level, but they also vary the most by race and ethnicity. We found that Blacks and Latino students have far lower transfer rates than white and Asian students.
And what about the students who go on to earn an associate's degree, a two-year degree?
Right. We also looked at associate's degree earning, and we found that some of these students are earning associate's degrees, about 10% of them. If we look at students who look at or who earn transfer status and also associate's degrees, the numbers go up a little, but we still find that about 30% or less of students who we characterize as transfer or degree seeking are actually earning these degrees.
Should we take these figures as signs of a problem?
I think so, because there are definitely a lot of students who come in just for a class or two, or come in for a vocational certificate, or, you know, for a non-credit type course, but a lot of these students aren't coming in for these purposes. A lot of students are coming in to transfer to a four-year institution or to earn a degree, and considering that about 70% of all college students in California are attending a community college, and the number is even higher for Black and Latino college students, about 80% of those types of students are attending community college. This shows definitely a problem.
Rhea Sengupta is research associate at the Public Policy Institute of California and co-author of the recent study, California's Community College Students. Also with us is Nancy Schulock, who's a professor and executive director of the Institute for Higher Education Leadership and Policy at Sacramento State. And she's co-author of the recent study, Rules of the Game, How State Policy Creates Barriers to Degree Completion and Impedes Student Success in the California Community Colleges. Nancy, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, your study claimed that the state's policy of removing barriers to access to college unintentionally inhibits student success. How is that?
Well, yes, I'm glad that you worded it that way. I want to back up, if I may, just for a second. The reason we did this study is because we're very concerned about projected shortages of college-educated workers for California's knowledge-based economy. There have been a number of studies preceding the two that you mentioned, ours and the PPIC study, that have projected shortfalls in college-educated workers for California and have also projected that the state's per capita income is going to decline, is already declining relative to other states, and will fall below the national average soon. And that's not the kind of golden state that we all expect to live in. So that's the motivation of this study. And we are convinced that these downward projections cannot be reversed without the community colleges enrolling and graduating more students, because as Rhea just said, they serve the vast majority of students in the state. They were designed to be the main pathway from high school to college attainment. And we, you mentioned your opening statements talked about the colleges coming up short. I would like to kind of phrase that a little differently. We are very careful to say it's not the colleges that are coming up short, it's our state policies. As you just mentioned, we state that for decades, actually, we've done such a good job making sure that through state policies there are very few, if any, barriers to students enrolling in the community colleges. And so our point here is that we need to give equal attention now, not to restricting access in any way, shape, or form, but giving equal access to making sure that students not only come in those open doors, but that we help them go through and out the other side, meeting their goals with a certificate, a degree, a transfer, or whatever their goals may be.
Is there any conflict between the removing of barriers to access and the inhibiting student success? I mean, is there a connection there?
Well, no, not as we see it. We're clear in the report that we think that the state, with the proper financing, with the proper incentives with their financing, with the proper policies, and we believe also with additional resources, that there is an institutional responsibility that can be fulfilled to help the students who enter the community colleges to succeed. That's what we have to do. I mean, that's the challenge for the state of California. We have, as I like to call it, the new California, and we have to get the new California educated, or we're not going to be able to reverse those troubling economic projections.
We're going to be talking more about this as the program unfolds, but can you give us a top-line summary of how California state policy is to blame here?
Let me give you a couple of examples, if I may. One of them is something that over 40 years ago, out of a genuine concern that we don't want to have administrative costs growing to the point of shutting, of detracting from direct instruction, there was a law passed that said that at least 50% of each college's budget needed to be devoted to direct classroom instruction. Well, things have changed quite significantly. Then that was, of course, to encourage access to classes and the faculty to teach those classes. But things have changed significantly since then in terms of the nature of the student body that is entering the community colleges and what they need to help them succeed. And students today, far more so than students in 1961 when this law was passed, benefit greatly from services, direct student support services like financial aid counseling, like academic advising and counseling and tutoring, peer counseling. And so these policies that were put in place over 40 years ago to foster access to classroom instruction now find themselves in many cases across the state preventing colleges from providing the very kinds of services that students now need more than ever before. So that's one example.
Sure.
Would you like additional examples?
No, that'll be fine for now.
Okay.
Rhea, a little while ago, Nancy explained why she co-wrote her study. Could you tell us why PPIC undertook its study of California's community college students?
Sure. We initially set out to look at course taking in California's community college and get a lay of the land, look at who's attending, why are they attending, what are some of their outcomes. So we looked at the age range of students within the community colleges. We looked at what percent were Latino, what percent were white. We looked at their previous educational level. And then in addition to that, we also looked at some of their more measurable outcomes, such as transfer status and also degree status. And that is where we found more of the problems within the community college system with students not coming out with the degrees that they perhaps were looking for when they were going in.
Did you go in expecting, did you go in because you believed, the PPIC believed there was a problem, or did you just go in to see what was going on?
We just went in to see what was going on and see what the community college system is so huge in California, and actually in the entire United States, it's the largest system. So we found that it's so important to higher education in California, which is why we initially wanted to look at the
statistics. Mm-hmm. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, more on California's community colleges. We'll keep our two researchers on the line, but we'll also talk with senior officials from California's community college system, as well as a college professor and a college student. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Are California community college students graduating in insufficient numbers with two-year associate degrees and transferring to university? Two recent studies each found a problem. The community college system says the success rate is actually higher. We still have on the line our two researchers that we talked with in the first part of the program, Rhea Sengupta of the Public Policy Institute of California and Nancy Schulock of Sacramento State. But we have some other guests to bring into the program who join us in our studio. And we'll start with Patrick Perry, who's Vice Chancellor of Technology, Research and Information Systems at California Community Colleges. Patrick, thanks for coming to Insight today.
Thank you.
According to the minutes of the recent board meeting of the California Community Colleges, Chancellor Mark Drummond described Nancy Schulock's and the PPIC's research as, quote, welcome. Does that mean he agreed with their findings?
No, I don't think he necessarily agreed with the findings. I think he welcomes the spotlight being on the community college system and what's going on in the community college system, but I don't necessarily think he agreed with the findings per se.
Where would he differ, or where would you differ on the findings?
Well, on the findings, I think the two reports have spawned a pretty good debate in the community college system, at least in the research circles, about what constitutes a success rate, how that is defined. And primarily in community colleges, it really comes down to defining who is here to get a degree, certificate, or transfer. In the two studies that have been come out here recently, they've defined transfer in one way, or intent to transfer in one way, primarily the course-taking patterns of a student in their first year, or in the case of the Schulock report, whether the student was 17 to 19 years old, or whether they had a goal of degree, certificate, or transfer. The community college system actually is coming out with its own accountability report coming out in March, and this has yet another methodology of defining who is a degree or certificate or transfer-seeking student, and it's based upon the course-taking patterns. Did they ever attempt transfer math or English, degree applicable math or English, and complete 12 units in the system? In this type of scenario, we're looking at students who are truly college-ready in equivalent sense. We're also measuring how colleges compare to each other.
If I can just summarize the PPIC report, fewer than one-tenth of community college students who concentrate on associate's degree courses eventually graduate with these degrees. As far as you know, is that correct? And if it is correct, is it a problem?
Well, everyone can have their own methodology, okay? I would say that our system-wide methodology, it certainly comes up with a different number. We are combining all the students who are degree, certificate, or transfer seeking, looking at them over the same period of time. And the number we come up with is about 50-51% from a system-wide level. Okay. Now, we're measuring different groups of students. We're defining transfer, certificate, and degree seeking in a different way. The issue of whether this is high or low is debatable, too. None of the methodologies have any national comparison to go against. So it's really difficult to tell what is low, what is high.
Would you give the same answer when I remind you of the PPIC's finding that about one quarter of those who concentrate on transfer courses eventually transfer to four-year institutions? Ditto?
Yeah, I would say ditto. It's another methodology and another way of counting.
Well, let's give Rhea Singupta a quick response to that. Rhea?
Yeah, I definitely agree that there are different ways of measuring, you know, the denominator of students that we're looking at. We found that the best way for us was to look at their course-taking behavior and what types of courses they're taking. And I agree that it's not very useful to, or it's not as useful as possible to compare it to national rates just because the composition of California's community college students is different, as well as the size and the number of students that they serve. But I think that we can all agree that there's definitely room for us to improve the number of students who are coming out of the system with degrees and also with transfer-level coursework.
Patrick, is that fair?
Yeah, and there's certainly, in all the studies, there is evidence that there are differences by age group, by ethnicity, regardless of what the overall rate is. So, yeah, absolutely, there's room for improvement everywhere.
May I make a comment on the methodology?
Yes, Nancy.
Yeah, this is Nancy. I just think maybe it gets kind of technical and inside baseball-y, and I just think maybe a good way to explain it is that the community college systems method only is looking, in the first instance, at students who've already attained quite a good measure of success, students who have already completed successfully 12 units and attempted college-level English or math. We don't think that it's reasonable to rule out students who never get to that measure of success. That's quite a strong threshold of success. We think that there may be, that there are a lot of other students who just never get that far precisely because of the many barriers in the policy environment that impede their progress. So we look at a much broader range of students, and we think that there's quite likely to be many students who never get that far who did intend to earn a certificate or an associate's degree or transfer.
Also with us in our studio is Bryce Harris, who's chancellor of the Los Rios Community College District. The Los Rios District runs four college campuses in the Sacramento region, American River, Cosumnes River, Folsom Lake, and Sacramento City. Bryce, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
How do things look at Los Rios? Do you see there the problems described in Nancy and Rhea's studies?
Well, I think, Jeffrey, to begin with, those of us in community colleges probably won't rest until all of our students achieve their educational goals. And so even if there were a small percentage who weren't achieving those goals, that would still leave us work to do. However, we think both of these studies do grossly underestimate the success patterns of our students. If you do include transfer-ready students, that number jumps up more than half. And when you look at our mission and how wide and varied it is, you realize that in addition to granting degrees and preparing for transfer, we have students involved in a variety of kinds of continuing education for teachers and accountants and nurses and police and fire folks. And the studies are based on the applications students fill out when they begin their education. And we know from tracking students on a semester by semester that those goals change, in fact, pretty dramatically over time.
Bryce and Patrick, I'm going to quote from the Sacramento State study. Historically, public policy has been focused on removing barriers to access. These policies have succeeded as California enjoys high rates of college enrollment. But these access-oriented policies have had the unintended consequence of inhibiting completion. I'd like to hear what both of you think about that. Bryce Harris.
Well, absolutely. These policies, thankfully, have generated more college attendees in California than perhaps any other state in the union. And when you open the doors wide to our institutions, that's something California can be extremely proud of. And if you look at the history of California and the innovation we've seen in this state, in large part, that's due to a very high college-going rate, not only at the community colleges, but the university systems as well. So I think too many people believe that access and student success are mutually exclusive, and I think that's the underlying suggestion, perhaps, in these reports. We don't believe that to be the case at all. Access is extremely important to California and certainly is student success. But the assumption is you can't have one, you must have one or the other, and we certainly don't believe that to be the case.
Patrick Perry?
The master plan laid out what the community colleges are supposed to be back in 1960, and it really did say we're taking everyone who is not UC and CSU eligible, and this is just the open access mission of the California community colleges. The policies that are in place now are, you know, a compilation of 40, 50 years of policy decisions made by the state that, like Nancy says, does define the rules of the game for the community college system. Community colleges are quite underfunded in California. We're one of the lowest funded systems in the nation for a community college. So we are doing the best that we can with the resources that we're given.
Nancy Schulock, would you like to respond to what we just heard?
Yeah, they are doing the best they can, absolutely, with the resources they have and with the policies that we have. And that's precisely our message, that if we change those policies without doing anything to restrict access, I think it's really disingenuous to imply that we are calling for a restriction in access when we have explicitly stated again and again that we're not doing so. And I think it would be, you know, it's one thing to say if we had all the policies lined up right, if we had all the incentives right for finance, if we had all the flexibility that the colleges need to do the right thing, if we had everything as, you know, as we would like to have it in our policy analysis, and then we still had, quote, low completion rates, then I think it would be okay to say, you know, we have this really, really tough mission and we're doing the best we can. But our point is let's not give up and say this is as good as we can do until we have all the policies right. And as I said, we name the report Rules of the Game precisely because we are saying the community colleges are in fact doing the very best they can given the rules of the game, given the policies, and given the resources. They absolutely need more resources and they absolutely need better policies. And then I think we could do better students and for the state of California.
Rhea Sengupta, your report for the PPIC was more descriptive than proscriptive, describing problems that you perceived. But what do you see being the causes of the problems that you described? Is it the quote, the rules of the game, or is it money, or both?
Well, our report definitely did not look at directly possible strategies, but there are definitely a number of ways to go. Similar to Dr. Schulock's report, we found that, you know, the younger the student, the more likely he or she will eventually transfer or earn a terminal degree. However, the last thing we would want to do is discourage older students from enrolling in community colleges because that is their major pathway towards higher education. There is a lot already being done, definitely. There was recent legislation that maybe Mr. Perry can talk more about than I can, but it was passed to create common course numbering systems between community colleges and CSU and UC systems to facilitate transfers and to make the process more transparent. And there are a lot of innovative programs going on at individual colleges that are addressing current problems. Just this week, I was talking to an instructor at Laney College in Oakland who had developed a digitized textbook program where students can listen to text out loud and read it online. And the program also embeds study notes and highlights inserted by instructors so students know where to focus. So I think some of the innovations are proving successful maybe at a more micro or college level. And as we move forward with this policy discussion, it's become more throughout the whole system.
We're talking today about success rates at California's community colleges. On the phone, Rhea Sengupta of the Public Policy Institute of California. You just heard her. Also on the phone, Nancy Schulock of Sacramento State. They both separately co-authored studies about the California community college system that were published recently. In our studio, you've already heard from Bryce Harris of the Los Rios Community College District and Patrick Perry, who's a vice chancellor at the California Community College System. Let's talk to a political science professor at a college. It's Matt Wettstein, who teaches political science at San Joaquin Delta College in Stockton. Matt, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
How does all this look from your point of view?
Well, from my point of view, I'm in the classroom daily with the students we're talking about, and I think that there needs to be a distinction, I think, drawn between students who are transfer-directed and really focused on completing their transfer coursework versus those who might have stated transfer as a goal or a degree as a goal on their application. The students who are, in fact, transfer-directed and taking the course patterns that are going to get them to their goal are really, in many ways, very good students. They represent the kind of student who could succeed anywhere, and in fact, they do when they transfer into the CSU and UC systems. They do extraordinarily well in comparison to freshmen who enroll at those universities. The difficulty is the other group who might have stated a goal and who have tremendous life pressures, family demands, the need to earn incomes that many of us don't think about when we attended college, for example, myself. And so they are students who have to sometimes come in and come out of college because of those demands. They drop courses at a much higher rate because of those pressures. And so the rates tend to look low because those students face the kind of pressures that they do.
It seems to me, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that the missions, the big mission of the UC and CSU systems are simpler and clearer than the mission of the California Community College system. And this is a question I'm going to pose to all of you, are California Community Colleges expected to be too many things to too many people? And we'll start with Matt Wettstein.
I think that's absolutely true. And the students who walk into the doors reflect those varied missions. It is a mission that, on the one hand, asks for career preparation or vocational specialized technical training. On the other hand, you have transfer educational goals. You have basic skills that need to be brushed up and improved. There are people taking courses for life enrichment and enhancement. And so the doors are open for all of those varied students. And it is, I think, very difficult for colleges to meet all of those various demands in a very meaningful way.
Patrick Perry, would the system as a whole agree that its mission is too broad?
Not necessarily. I think the mission of the system has been defined in the past as being what it is now. I think the task is very difficult, as Matt said, because in the same classroom you may have students on one hand who are, you know, in ESL, and on the other end you have a student who is on a fast track to go to University of California. That is a wide swath of student to have to handle in the same classroom setting.
Bryce Harris, would you support a tightening, a focusing of the mission of the colleges?
Absolutely not. You know, the Census Bureau study reveals that taking even one community college course has an impact of increasing compensation for a worker by 8%. We have students that are with us for a variety of reasons, and our mission is very wide and very deep. Now, at times, we don't feel as if we're supported adequately for that mission, but California desperately needs its community colleges to do each and every plank of that mission.
Nancy Shulock, is the broad focus, the broad sweep of the California Community Colleges one of the quote-unquote problems of the rules of the game?
No, I don't think so. I agree with Dr. Harris completely. I mean, from time to time, the legislature will get faced with this question, and they think about, well, which mission should we put at a lower priority? And, of course, none, because they're all high priorities. The community colleges have to step up and do what none of the other segments of education do. That's totally appropriate. I think we just need to be clearer. I think students need better guidance, for one thing, and that's one of the policy areas that we talk about. Students need more information because, as the professor mentioned, so many of them come from backgrounds where they really don't know much about college. They don't know what their options are. So they need better guidance as to which of those different pathways they might want to follow. But absolutely, I would not say that there are too many missions. I think we just have to do a better job of helping students figure out which is the pathway for them and what they need to do to be successful on that pathway. And, of course, the resources have to be appropriate and commensurate to each of the different missions.
And Rhea Singupta?
I agree. The community college system is serving various different missions, but each mission is indispensable for California. The community colleges serve communities in ways that the UCs and CSUs simply do not and cannot, providing vocational education, basic skills, for example, and the system is the only one with the missions and enrollment policies and flexibility to fit the needs of all different types of students. So they're all missions that the state desperately needs.
Let's bring in our final guest. Philip Austin is an evening student at Cosumnes River College, majoring in building inspection technology and construction management. Philip, welcome to Insight.
Hello.
How does all this look to you as a student?
I keep focusing on the end user of the product of community colleges, that being the graduating or transferring student. My thoughts with concern to funding of the community college mission, as varied as it is, has a lot to do with not legislation, but with partnership between the community colleges and some of the large global corporations in the state of California that would utilize those students.
What role do students play in this? I realize that that one could debate for many hours over the methodology and the data here, but if we accept for the purpose of this question that not enough California Community College students are graduating with associate degrees or transferring to universities, what role are the students, as far as you can tell as a student yourself, what role do they play in this, if any?
The role that the students play in this is one in which we have to demand that the policies are geared towards getting the guidance that was spoken of earlier, guidance for developing a transfer plan or a graduation plan, and also to demand that we have a place to take that degree once we actually have obtained it. I think that in the Sacramento area, in the greater Sacramento area, there are any one of a number of different corporations, from Hewlett-Packard to Apple to NEC, all of those corporations utilize students that would eventually come out of this pipeline. Yet, we don't really perform any sort of, say, internship or apprenticeship programs with those corporations. That would be an interesting way of either coming up with the funding and or the staffing towards human resource needs that we haven't looked at in this study, as far as I can tell.
I'd like to talk for a minute or two about the four-year universities. Patrick Perry, from your perspective, is there anything that the four-year universities, CSU and UC in particular, could do to change the way they operate, the way they accept the students from community colleges, that would increase the number of community college students who transfer?
Sure, absolutely. There's a lot of policies that are at CSU and UC that affect a community college student's ability to transfer. One of them, Rhea mentioned, is the issue of course articulation between the segments. A student really faces kind of a nightmarish scenario sometimes of what courses will be accepted by the receiving institution. Depends on what type of articulation agreement a community college has with the UC or a local CSU, but sometimes if they're going to a different CSU or UC, all of their courses might not be accepted. They may end up having to take excess units, which cost the state more. So things like that. Also, enrollment management policies going on at CSU and UC. They also are having to manage their enrollments. The number of annual transfers going from the community colleges to CSU bounces around, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 students every year. And that's actually not a good thing. Students need to have a stable articulation type of environment in which to do the transferring.
Bryce Harris, anything to add?
Yes, you know, here in Los Rios last year, we had more than 4,000 students who transferred to UC and CSU, and we had an additional 7,000 who were transfer ready and for whatever reason did not transfer. I frankly would love to see some research on why those students aren't, after completing 60 units and preparing for transfer, not going on to one of the university systems, a private university or a university outside of state. I think that is really a critical point that we need to be looking at, not only at community colleges, but we need the help of the universities in that regard as well.
May I make a comment, please?
Yeah, please.
I would like to address what Dr. Harris said. I think that a lot of students don't get, say, follow-up after they have graduated or completed those 60 units, whether you've graduated or not. Would it be possible for the community college system to, say, send out some sort of survey or do some sort of research similar to this as to where are you now for the community colleges?
Okay.
Well, I'd obviously love to see the universities take a look at that. We sort of get those students ready for transfer, and for a variety of reasons, they don't transfer. I think part of them have to stop out for a while to prepare financially. I think part of them have life changes that intervene. I think a number of them change their goals after they've completed 60 units, and they want to go right into the world of work. But as far as the community colleges are concerned, we really have prepared those students well for transfer if that's what they want to do. And so I'd love to see CSU and UC take on the task of looking at those students and judging what, if anything, they and we could do to increase those numbers.
We need to wrap this up now. So I'll ask each of you to to see anything that you haven't had a chance to see yet that you think is important, or see something that you would like to see changed in the system. Let's start with Matt Wettstein of Delta College.
Well, I think I would come back to the problem of what I would call the expectations gap, that there are many students who come into the community college system who have an expectation of what the work will be like that is really not on par with what the demands will be from a college-level course. And so they come into the course expecting it to perhaps be easier, less difficult, that they can manage their time and family pressures better. And so that gap in expectations from what I demand as a professor or an instructor and what they might have expected is often there. And somehow we need to address that gap through orientation programs and getting them ready for studying mm-hmm. in college.
Rhea Sengupta?
Well, I would just like to emphasize how important the community college system is for California as a state to improve the education of our workforce and improve our economic prospects and the collaboration that's necessary with, we talked about the UC and CSU system, but also with the K-12 public education system. This goes to say with students coming in unprepared for the system, improvements in the K-12 system might improve California community college outcomes as well.
Philip Austin?
I think that this particular problem is not going to be solved with just legislation, and that all college systems within the state of California, be they community college, UC, we have to look at partnering with the businesses that are going to be utilizing the final product, which is the student. Talk with those people and find out what they need and help and partner with them in order to find a way to get those students there.
Patrick Perry?
Yeah, one of the things I wanted to leave with was the issue that affects all of higher ed, and that is the great dependence all of higher ed has on the state budget. You know, our very progressive taxation system in California leads to unstable funding for all the segments. Our system is down 300,000 students from the early 90s, partially due to a combination of budget cuts and fee increases, and we're still now climbing out from underneath that. We definitely need a stable funding source for all of higher ed.
Nancy Schulach?
Yeah, we've tried in this report to show just how absolutely fundamental the community colleges are to the health of California. So I guess what I'm hoping will happen is that the community college system and all of its colleges will say, you know, thank you for telling everybody how absolutely important we are. Let's get together. We may not agree with all of your solutions, but let's sit down and see what we can do to make things better for the students in the state so that we can continue to live in the golden state that we expect to live in.
And final word from Bryce Harris.
As Dr. Schulach said, these institutions are extremely valuable to California. I think I do worry a bit about recommendations that at least imply the limiting of access and the increasing of fees, the reduction of full-time faculty, and the decreased spending on direct instruction. And so I prefer to take a glass-half-full view of California's community colleges and the really remarkable things they are accomplishing each and every day. And I hope that we don't take a overly simplistic approach to policy, state-level policy recommendations that really sort of tinker around when in reality the challenge of these institutions, as you've heard earlier, is that they are basically dramatically underfunded for the mission that we're trying to accomplish for the citizens of California.
Well, thank you to all of our guests. On the phone, researchers Rhea Sengupta of the Public Policy Institute of California and Nancy Schulach of Sacramento State, and Cosumnes River College student Philip Austin, and in our studio, Bryce Harris, you just heard, Chancellor of the Los Rios Community College District, Patrick Perry, a Vice Chancellor at the California Community Colleges, and Matt Wettstein, Public Political Science Professor at San Joaquin Delta College in Stockton. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, as the world gets warmer, species will probably start moving to cooler places. Ecologists want to know, should we help them along the way? We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callis. And later this week, renowned peace activist Phil Steger, also some young jazz musicians in town for this weekend's Youth Traditional Jazz Festival. Earlier this week, we met Kim Phuc, the Vietnamese woman who, when a girl, was at the center of the famous photograph of victims of a napalm attack. Former Sacramento Bee cartoonist Dennis Renaud faxed us a copy of a piece he did around the time of Robert McNamara's Mea Culpa. In 1995, the Vietnam War-era Secretary of Defense admitted knowing at an early date that the U.S. could not win that war. It's a poignant cartoon. It shows the young Kim Phuc running down a road in agony, pursued by McNamara with his suit and briefcase, shouting out, "Pardon me, miss, I'm Robert McNamara. Have you read my apology to the Vietnamese?" Back to today's program. The Earth is warming up and is expected to get hotter still. Many plants and animals will seek cooler homes. A big question among ecologists: should humans give the migrating species a helping hand? A UC Davis plant ecologist co-wrote an important new paper on this topic. It's called A Framework for Debate of Assisted Migration in an Era of Climate Change. He's Dr. Mark Schwartz, a professor of environmental science and policy and director of the UC Davis Center for Population Biology. Mark Schwartz, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
First, can you put the problem in perspective? How hot is the Earth today and how hot do we think it's going to get?
Well, it's Jeffrey, it's moved up about a degree in centigrade over the last century or so from early 20th century temperatures, and it's expected to move up another 3 to 8 degrees over the next 100 to 150 years. The IPCC, government intergovernmental body on climate change, has just come out with a new report in the last 10 days or so, strengthening their conclusions on climate change and verifying that the 3 to 8 degrees seems to be the right prediction for the next 150 years or so.
Your paper is about assisted migration. Shouldn't we just leave the plants and animals to figure out for themselves if they want to move?
Well, that's a good point. That one of the major areas of ecology has been studying how plants and animals have shifted to, in response to past climatic changes, and they've been very responsive. And if we look at the distribution shifts associated with plants and animals under the current climate change, we see, in fact, compelling evidence that plants and animals are moving in response to this climate change. But it's a subset of those plants and animals. Butterflies, birds, things that have a high capacity for dispersal are moving fine, but the ones that don't, many ant-dispersed plants, for example, they have no real capacity to keep pace with this rapid climate change that we're experiencing now today.
Where are the species that have moved? Where are they going?
They're generally going upslope in the Sierras often and northward. So towards cooler climates is what we're predicting. And some of the predictions for potential future distributions under these climate change models suggest that species may move upwards of 500 kilometers northward in the eastern half of the United States. So it's quite a large migration for these species. And for birds, things that move many hundreds of kilometers during their lifespan, this is not a large issue. But for understory herbaceous plants, for example, this is really beyond the expectation of what we might consider that they could do on their own.
The current global warming is unique because it's largely or entirely perhaps created by humans. But still, there have been many global warmings in the past, and presumably species managed just fine. Yeah. Why wouldn't they manage just fine this time?
Well, there's really two reasons there. One of them is a rate of change. The rate of this climate change is very rapid, and that is going to cause some problems with migration. The second is that we have a large human footprint on the landscape that is fragmenting the habitat through which they would have migrated and may remove much of the suitable habitat that they could have been occupying as they moved northward. They no longer can do this, and therefore they may be left isolated in these old habitats. The problem comes when we start thinking about this as a strategy, because it really pits conservationists against conservationists in a way that we often don't recognize. That one paradigm of conservation is that we should be helping protect species diversity, that we should be avoiding extinction at all cost. And that model would suggest that we should be helping species move. But one other model for conservation that we're probably much more comfortable with is that we would like to maintain habitats that, with which we're familiar with ecosystems. So, for example, we may be familiar with the coast redwood ecosystem as a place we go to and we know what it looks like and we feel comfortable in this environment. And if we were to start bringing species into that environment, this violates some sense of our sense of that as a natural place. And so,
with possible unintended consequences.
With huge possible unintended consequences. Invasive species cost this country hundreds of millions of dollars each and every year. And our track record on predicting when a species moved from one location to another will be a problem and when it won't be a problem isn't particularly high. And so if we were to start helping species that are being left behind by climate change, moving them from one place to another, we are going to be causing a certain number of these problems, and we just aren't very good at predicting when those will happen.
So have you stirred up the metaphorical hornet's nest?
Well, yes and no, in that this is a hornet's nest that needs to be stirred, that ecologists have been looking at the potential threats of global climate change to biodiversity for a number of years now, and they've really come up with two solutions. One is to stop global warming, and that's not going particularly well. We're not slowing carbon emissions much. The other is to create networks of reserves that are connected so that species could migrate along those landscapes. And there's some success in that area. But there's certainly clear evidence of some species that are being left behind. And that just begs the question of this third alternative is, do we want to move species? And I really got involved in this issue because I work on a tree in the eastern United States where people are actually now moving it from northern Florida to South Carolina on behalf of conservation.
Because of global warming?
Well, for a variety of reasons. It's not so much explicitly because of global warming, but it's a species that's endangered in its natural habitat. It's declining. It has an introduced fungal disease that's killing off all the adults. It's not recovering in its natural distribution, and it tolerates cooler climates. And so the suggestion has been made, why don't we just move it north for its conservation? And these people genuinely feel that they're doing a conservation service by moving these species from northern Florida up to South Carolina, not really considering how the folks of South Carolina may view receiving this new species into their ecosystem.
Mark Schwartz is a plant ecologist at UC Davis and co-author of a major scientific paper on the subject of assisted migration, which is an analysis of whether and how to move species to cooler places to escape the consequences of global warming. How on earth would we figure out how to move species? Some, I'm sure, are easier than others.
Well, yeah, exactly. That's a big problem. Moving the species themselves isn't very hard. We have shovels and trucks, and we've been pretty good at moving species around. It's deciding when we're going to move a species and when we're not going to move a species. That's the tricky part. And this is why... what we're trying to call for in this paper is for scientists and policymakers to get together to have a strategy, because at the present time, our public landowning agencies like the Forest Service, the National Park Service, and California Fish and Game, they don't really have an explicit policy of when they should move species on behalf of their conservation. We do know that when we have an endangered species like a tiger salamander or something, and you have a development going into an area and you encounter a tiger salamander, you pick it up and you move it to another habitat nearby. And the state of California is ahead of the curve and is right now trying to develop translocation policies for those sorts of things. But it's still on a very local basis. It's not saying, well, if these tiger salamanders can no longer exist in Sacramento County, should we move them up to Redding? And that's a bridge we haven't crossed yet.
Well, the shovel works nicely with a tree, and salamanders are pretty small creatures, but bears would probably have something to say about it if we tried to move them somewhere else. And what about fish that live in waters that are heating up, like salmon? How could we possibly move them?
Well, that's true. The aquatic organisms present a unique case unto itself. But interestingly, there's a crayfish in the central United States where its river that it was native to was dammed, and sedimentation in the river was degrading its habitat. And so people, on behalf of its conservation, picked it up and moved it into an adjacent watershed where it's now become a problematic invasive species. So just exactly the sort of thing that we're talking about, of helping a species by moving it into a new system. Moving it into a new system becomes a problem that we didn't have before. So it's a mixed bag.
And finally, how have your peers and science journalists reacted to your paper?
Well, people are interested. I think that it's something people have thought about vaguely. There's a lot of interest in having structured discussions about this issue. My colleagues and I have are planning now a workshop where we bring together policymakers and scientists together to discuss this issue. That we find that scientists, when forced to explicitly confront this topic, find themselves conflicted internally about whether they view themselves this biodiversity imperative to be greater or less than this community or ecosystem imperative for conservation, and it's a struggle that we have to face.
I can imagine. Mark Schwartz is a plant ecologist at UC Davis. He's a professor of environmental science and policy and director of the UC Davis Center for Population Biology. He's co-author of a major scientific paper on the subject of assisted migration that appeared or appears soon.
It'll appear soon, yes.
Appear soon in Conservation Biology, which is the journal of the Society for Conservation Biology. Mark, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up in the KXJZ stations, today's news on the world. Insight staff is Technical Director Mark Jones, Acting Assistant Producer Natalie Breen, and Acting Senior Producer Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. The Grammys are this Sunday. Who's going to win? Who should win? Next time in Insight, local music experts and Grammy voters give you their picks and play clips from some of the top rock, pop, R&B, jazz, and classical music of the past year. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
That's tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the KXJZ stations.